Thanks, Mike, and thanks to all three of the organisers, I think on behalf of all of us, for organising such a great workshop. It's been great, personally, for me to be here and finally see the film. And we actually need to have another round of applause. Belen, you just missed your applause. So let's... So one of the things I've particularly enjoyed about this workshop is how it's brought people together from all these different fields. It's been great to have someone from neuroscience here and physics and philosophy and computer science. And if I've missed anybody out, I'm sorry. The work that I'm presenting sits at the interface of those three fields. I haven't yet found an application to neuroscience, but that would be awesome to talk about. And so I've given talks on this before, but always to people in one field or another. So given my background is in both physics and computer science and philosophy, it's great to finally be able to give this talk trilingually, which is very, very appropriate for Canada as well. So I've just moved to Grenoble, which is in the French Alps. Quantum engineering project has just started up there. As these things should do, it's bringing together physics and computer science, and because it's France, it's also brought in philosophy. And so part of what I want to say is, hello, we're now here. This project is now ramping up. Come visit us. And if you visit over the summer, then you get to see the beautiful alpine scenery in summer. And if you visit over the winter, then you get to go ski. So after that brief plug, so I was originally put down to do this on Tuesday and then moved to do it last. And so I decided, how can I get back at the organisers for making me talk after the pub night? I thought, well, that's kind of easy, because basically what I'm going to talk about is why the whole project of algorithmic information theory is wrong. Only because this is Canada and I'm British, I'm going to do it a little bit more politely. And say what I'm going to present is where I think it falls slightly short and is... And some parts of the whole framework that really could do with a little bit more thought and a little bit more formalism. And here's one I made earlier. So with that in mind, let's get started. So some of you, I know some people have talked to me about it, said, is this an AR theory talk? I said, yes, this is about abstraction representation theory, which is what I've been developing with my two collaborators, Susan Stepney and Viv Kendon, and we've also been collaborating with some other people along the way. So in algorithmic information theory, as we've heard this week, and in a lot of other ways, we've kind of got used to hearing the language of information theory cropping up in the physical sciences, in the natural sciences. People will kind of talk very loosely about systems computing or human beings processing information, or even, you know, leaves processing information is something that I personally come across. And to a greater or lesser extent, I would say most of these are imprecise uses of terminology. And I think most people who actually work around computer science and algorithmic information theory would in fact agree with that, to say that there is a problem of hand-waviness going on here. So how can we make that precise? How can we make the use of this informational and computational language about physical systems precise? And the way I go about it, the way I've attacked it here, is through considering computation. Because my background is very much quantum computing. and also the theory of other non-standard physics, physical computational devices. So I'll talk sometimes about non-standard computing, sometimes about unconventional computing. So what I'm meaning is everything that is not standard classical silicon-based substrate computing. So everything that is not make a whole load of bits on a silicon substrate and then, you know, put an app on it and sell it for hyperinflated amounts of money. And when you start looking at unconventional computing devices, or even, God forbid, trying to build them, you realize that the whole stack of classical computing knowledge and theoretical frameworks really does not translate very well. And so abstraction representation theory came out of that problem, came out of that, well, we've got this whole stack of you know, verification and lambda calculi and whatever, and we've got quantum computers or whatever. And how do we fit, you know, tab A into slot B? Because they don't seem to go. And what we came to an understanding of is that this is fundamentally about representation, that how do we represent physical systems abstractly? That step that often gets glossed over, and I would say is the step in programs like algorithmic information theory, that's the step that's wrong. That step just gets taken as fundamental, primitive, and we don't need to interrogate it. That step is everything that I'm going to be talking about. And we start off looking at the most basic point where we have representation, and that's in science. The scientific representation here is fundamental. How do we model the physical world, and how do we deal with the dynamics of it? And we'll see how going through the steps from modeling through to testing scientific theories, and then to engineering and technology, leads us ultimately to being able to represent computing. And as part of that, we end up with a formalization of observers. And they're not observers, because observation is a red herring very much in this, that what their fundamental role is as representational entities, that what they're doing is setting up this ability to represent physical systems as abstract notions. And finally, I'm going to talk a bit about when we go backwards, when we've reached an understanding of what a computer is and how we can use terminology about computing, about a physical system, how can we then use that language for systems that aren't explicitly computers? So that's the logic of what I'm going to be talking about. Some references. This was the original paper that we came up with in 2014. Here are some of the next papers. I think everybody knows that my name, or if you didn't know, my name changed in between here and here. I do just like to check everybody's on board with this, because occasionally I have people thinking that they've previously interacted with my sister, but no, it's all me. But the other thing about this is, I said this is at the interface of computer science, physics, and philosophy, and that's where we've published. I mean, Proceedings of the Royal Society's Physics. I presented this at the philosophy conference, and then we recently had this. This was actually invited viewpoint in CACM. So that's nice and digestible. That's like three pages if you want a very brief outline.
Is it in the archive?
No, but it's open access. And of course, I couldn't complete this without giving a plug to Mike's book. So this book is just about to come out.
Yes, in June.
In June, right? Okay. So this book is very good, not just because of this article. And has been a labor of many years for Mike and co. Okay, so the use of information theoretic language in physics and a lot of other sciences is not new. And in fact, the dislike of the widespread use of information theoretic language is also not new. So this is a short one-page article that Claude Shannon wrote in the mid-50s. Basically saying, okay, guys, I know I invented this cool thing called information theory, but can you just stop applying it to absolutely everything, please? So I encourage you to read it. There's PDFs all over the internet. But it starts off with, you know, information theory has in the last few years become something of a scientific bandwagon. You know, plus ça change, that was 50, 60 years ago. And then it goes on, our fellow scientists in many different fields, attracted by the fanfare and by the new avenues open to scientific analysis, are using these ideas in their own problems. I do have a little, you know, you get the sense of how dare they under there. Applications are being made to biology, psychology, linguistics, fundamental physics, economics, theory of organization, and many others. In short, information theory is currently partaking of a somewhat heady draft of general popularity. And he goes on to say, cool it. You know, there's nothing that is rigorous about the vast majority of the uses of the few exciting words like information, entropy, and redundancy, and they do not solve all of our problems. And this guy then in 2012 decided he would illustrate this bandwagon. So that, I think that's a little unfair, shall we say. But I think it's something that we do need to keep in the back of our mind, because so very often people will just throw out these ideas of computation and information without putting the framework underneath that says, well, why can you apply those information theoretic concepts to something that looks a priori completely different? And this is particularly, or one example of a particular problematic case is thermodynamics, where just because you have an expression for entropy that is the same as the Shannon entropy, the people have kind of thrown up their hands and gone, that's it, that solved everything, they're obviously the same quantity. But they're very different. One is a physical quantity, and one is the abstract information content. And just saying, oh, these two things are the same, leads to, well, why are they the same? How are they the same? What is the fundamental mapping between the two? If all you've got is mathematics, you don't have any kind of physical explanation for what's going on there. And this is something that also, taken to its extreme, people will say things like, oh, the whole universe is a computer. Everything in the universe is computing. Who knows what, but everything in the universe is computing at every moment of time. And I'm just putting up Seth and Flatco as indicative of this rather than trying to sort of explicitly shame them or anything. But this is very widespread. And if you want an absolute reductio ad absurdum of this argument, then Hilary Putnam came up with his rock, which he has an argument that any rock implements every finite state automata and essentially maps. So time slices a rock sitting there. I should have brought a rock in. Time slices a rock state and then essentially uses a lookup table between the state at any time and the state of a given finite automata, and maps between the two and says, there is a mapping, therefore, from this rock doing nothing to this incredibly complicated finite state automata. In fact, anyone that you want. Therefore, a rock is capable of universal computation, not only is capable, is actually implementing it at every point in time.
Can you review the details of how that argument works? Or should I map states of rocks to states of silicon?
I don't want to spend too long on it because I've got things that are not absurd to talk about.
Is the idea that the coding changes over time? Or?
So rock at time t1, rock at time t2, rock at time t3, complicated finite state automata at time one. And then this is evolving. This actually has an evolution, whereas this does nothing. You know, the idea is the physical state of the rock, it's just sitting there. And so this mapping, if you like, does all the work. So that's what I mean by it's a reductio ad absurdum argument. Because
different maps.
Well, no, it's so one, two. Yeah, so you say the map is the collection of all the maps at all the different times. Actually, I wanted to find a picture of a rock, so I Googled Putnam's rock.
What's the internal state of the finite automaton corresponds to what? The position of the rock?
Well, it's just mapping. So you can map anything to anything else if you're able to have a complex mapping. Yeah, it's saying take a small delta t. The rock during that delta t is one state. The rock during the next delta t is another, and another, and another.
Yeah. It's a reductio against what?
Well, I'm saying this is the obvious, or this is a push the idea of pan-computationalism that everything computes at every time to its absurd limit. I don't think that's what Putnam was thinking he was doing. But that's if you like, the ultimate argument that you can make. If you...
Lloyd and Bedrill would have a good response to why this does not form a reductio against...
I've no idea. It'd be good to ask them.
Yeah. You mean this location function should be simple, like Markus Hutter's talk. It's really related to that.
Well, it is related because I've spent a lot of the last few days kind of having this in the back of my mind, because if you ignore your maps, then you can smuggle any amount of computation you like in that. And this is basically bringing that out to the fore. That your mapping matters, your encoding matters. How you represent one thing in terms of another matters. It's not direct. So this is things like when I Googled Putnam's rock, there are apparently a lot of Putnams out there. I couldn't actually find a picture of a rock.
There's a lot of computation going on Putnam's stock.
So how can we do better than that? How can we put a rigorous meaning to all of this information theoretic language? Am I just going to say, right, that's it, it's all rubbish, go home. You know, give up on algorithmic information theory and only use the language of information theory and computation when you're dealing with actual computers or actual signals? I don't think that's true, but I think we've got an awful lot of work before we can get to an understanding of when we can use computational language and make that rigorous. So I'm going to approach that, as I said, through this question of when is a physical system computing? And there's two extremes that we need to avoid. There is the pan-computational rock thing that everything computes everything all of the time. But then I would also like to avoid the other extreme where we have to sprinkle some kind of magic consciousness or intention or whatever it is to make a physical process turn into a computation. So what I'm going to do is start with, first of all, an argument of why we think this is a question that needs to be answered with reference to the physical system itself. Because very often in computer science, and we've heard that this week, the language of computer science tends to be very much the language of mathematics and tends to treat computation as simply a branch of mathematics. So why would we think that computation has anything to do with physics? And this is my proposal, which I'm now going to very briefly try and back up, that on the contrary, physics and the physical systems that you're dealing with are integral to computer science, and computer science is the science, the natural science, of their computing abilities. So rather than treating computer science as purely abstract, I'm saying, no, you need to put the physical system in there, right in the foundations. So why would I even begin to think this? Well, right from the very beginning, computer science has been about computers as physical objects. Nobody sort of zoomed in and made a mathematics of computer science before we had actual computers. So right at the beginning, Babbage created his difference engine, and then Ada Lovelace came along and went, you know what, we can do a theory of that. And so she was theorizing, when she created computer science, about the analytic engine, but that was a machine based on the difference engine. The difference engine came first. And then Turing, too, was dealing with a very specific machine. So he started, because he was theorizing about the bomb and also previously about the very first computers, which were human beings. So that was the first use of the term computer, was as a human being who computed. And so he was trying to abstract out the theory behind these physical machines. And what he did has kind of taken over, to the extent that, given every physical computer that we normally have access to is based on his theories, very often people forget that there is actually this physical reasoning underlying it and just say, oh, well, computation and computing is the theory of the sort of devices Turing was dealing with. And there's an immediate response to that, which is, well, at the same time, there was another general theory of computation that was being developed. This is Claude Shannon, and he developed the GPAC, so General Purpose Analog Computer, is a theoretical model of computation that was designed to explain what happens in a differential analyzer. And you can argue backwards and forwards about whether a GPAC is interchangeable with the Turing machine and where, you know, the extent to which you can simulate analog computing on digital computing. But the fundamental point is that these are two different ways that people tried to develop a computer science based on two different paradigms of the actual physical device. And what happened was they developed in parallel for a little bit, but then the bit-based technology took over, just became very much better. And so most people forgot about the analog-based technology. And so it's not really the computer scientist's fault that they think computer science is just abstract and mathematical, because up till now, or in the last 60 years, it's only been about one type of physical implementation. So you could pretty much ignore the physical implementation. But now we're at the stage where you can't do that anymore. And this is the very first reason, or the most pressing reason, is because we've now got quantum computing. And you can say, theoretically, oh, you can simulate a quantum Turing machine on a classical Turing machine. Well, that's nice. I want to program that. And mapping everything in classical computing theory down to a classical Turing machine, mapping it onto a quantum Turing machine, and then trying to map it up to some kind of quantum high-level programming language, that's a loop nobody has yet done. It is far too complicated. It may not even be possible. That's not an argument I want to have here. This is simply to say that we are developing new computational theories based on new hardware. And it's not just quantum computers. DNA computation. How do you program a DNA computer? How do you program this thing? So this is a robot that is controlled by a slime mold. So slime molds are a non-standard computing system. They will grow into shortest paths, and so they're considered some type of optimization machine. They take several hours, so they're not very useful yet. But you can make one control a robot. But how do you write the programming language for that? What about this one? So this is the OpenWorm project, which is brilliant. It's taken a nematode worm, simulated it, and then used that simulation to control a Lego robot. But what's the computational theory of this thing? What about this one? This is possibly my favorite, because this was extracting rat neurons, putting them on a silicon substrate, and then having them fly a flight simulator. So it's rats on a plane. But again, what on earth would you put as the underlying computational model for that? What else have we got? Well, this is an interesting one. So this is something that computer scientists are now starting to talk about. Social machines. So human beings glued together using technology to do computations. How do you program a social machine? So all of that is to show that we are now at the stage where you have to think about the physical implementation when you're doing your computational theory. And all of these come down to, we can model all of this with, there's a physical world and there's an abstract world. And in the physical world, or in the abstract world, we've got our notions of computation. So that's everything that we model in terms of bits and gates and so on and so forth. And then we've got a physical world where actual computers sit. So from now on, when I talk about computation, I talk about above the line, and computing, I talk about below the line. So how do we get between the two? What is it that enables us to take a model of computation and build a computer out of it? Now, is it just, as has typically been the case up to now, is it just engineering, that computer scientists deal with above the line and then they throw out the specs and the engineers, like some kind of elves, just magically create the computer out of it? Well, that line now isn't working for non-standard computing, including quantum computing. And that interface is exactly where abstraction representation theory sits. So what we're trying to do is formalize this interface. So, how do we do that? Well, what is the thing that goes across that interface? What takes us from physical systems to abstract systems? That's the action of representation. You represent something physical as something abstract. And so what abstraction representation theory is the theory of that representation relation. How does it work? What I am not going to talk about is what it could possibly be, because that's the point at which anybody who is a philosopher of science in the audience is like, we need a week to talk about this. I'm saying we do this. We know we do this. We represent physical things abstractly. So let's start from that position, sort of black box representation, and say, well, how does it work? What properties does it have? So the first property that it has is that it takes us over this line. So for instance, we've got an atom. I Googled atom and that came up. And we've got an abstract representation in terms of the Schrodinger equation. And the representation relation is the map from the physical to the abstract. That's how I'm using it. What is that map? Well, it takes as input physical objects and it outputs abstract objects. So it cannot possibly be either a logical or a mathematical function. Those would both be category errors, because logical and mathematical functions both take abstract inputs to abstract outputs. So it is a thing in itself. So there are various philosophers who have dealt with representation. I am not solving the problems of representation, as I said, but merely saying if we have any kind of abstract representation of the world, then we must have a representation relation. Very brief context to that, just to say for anyone who is in this field where I'm sitting. So Rorty in 1979 basically completely demolished this idea that you have a mirror world in the abstract, that somehow the abstract world mirrors the physical world. So I'm not doing mirroring of abstract and physical. Draw a lot on Van Frassen, even though he's coming at it from an empiricist point of view, I'm coming at it very much from a realist point of view. So the physical world exists and can be part of our theories about it rather than just experiments. But a lot of what he says about how representation is dependent on scientific theories and is part of a scientific theory rather than prior to it, that's what I take on board. And I mentioned this briefly the other day in a question. One thing that I'm very much not going along with is Carnap's program, where he tried to turn the physical universe somehow into sense data, and then everything could be done on top of this sense data. And he repudiated that. Everybody else basically said, well, you can't have theory-independent observations next. Also to say, this is starting from a physical perspective on computation, rather than a lot of the time people will come at it from an idea of semantics, from meaning, and sort of see, if you like, the abstract physical divide in computing as mirroring the mind-brain divide. I'm saying it may end up that we can talk to that, but that's not where we're starting from. We're starting from the notion of scientific representation, that is how you get between abstract and physical. Very briefly, just to say, in computer science, when I give this talk to computer scientists or a similar talk, they'll say, but we've got that. You know, we've got, in fact, diagrams that look like the ones I'm going to draw, where you start out with your concrete semantics, and that's your physical computer, and then you refine upwards to more abstract semantics and programming languages. And the point I'm making is that in that view, the concrete semantics in computer science is itself an abstract representation. It's a very low-level abstract representation, but it's still nevertheless not the physical computer itself, but a representation of it. When I talk about the physical system, I mean the actual physical system. So with that in mind, let's go through, if you like, a fundamental use of representation. So this is, we take a physical system P, use a representation relation, which is indexed by T, which is the physical theory that the representation is part of, and we get an abstract object corresponding to the physical object. And we can turn the diagrams, so AR theory has a diagrammatic form, it also has an quasi-algebraic term form, and so we deal with these representational triples. So this is the physical object, the representation relation, and the corresponding abstract. So that's the modeling relation, this. This is how do we model physical system P in theory T as abstract object M of P. But that's not all of what we do in science. We don't just model things, we use those models. And the first thing you need to ask scientifically is, what makes a good model? And part of what we do to determine what makes a good model is experimental science. So there are uses for what we saw. A lot of people have talked about complexity and simplicity of theories and choosing between them. That's part of scientific theory choice. But also, we just do experiments. We see how well does this abstract model predict the evolution for the physical devices, and we can represent that. So this is an experiment. We take a model, and the physical system itself undergoes some evolution to another state. And when we're testing a scientific theory, we will have a corresponding abstract evolution. So there will be the scientific theory will predict, using possibly dynamics or something like a least energy principle, will predict a final state. So now we're kind of at a problem, because we've run an experiment, we've got our abstract prediction of what's going to happen, and we've got the final state of the experiment. Well, how do you compare them?
RT again.
Sorry?
You use RT again.
Mm. Yes, you do. And this is something that philosophers of science know all about. You have to represent the outcome of your experiment in your theory in order to compare with your theory. And this is the theory dependence of observation. This is the fact that you don't have a language that can describe these, if you like, sui generis. You have to use some kind of theory to tell you what that particular experimental outcome is. I mean, if you want to think about sort of a standard laboratory setup, you're testing some kind of hypothesis like, does this energy level emit at this frequency? Well, your experiment on the table does not kind of pop up a little sign saying, yes. What happens is you get a whole load of data coming across your various output devices, and you have to collate all of those to see whether or not it has. And so that's what's going on there. Now, you'll notice the representation, the abstract representation of the final state of the experimental device. I've not said this is the same as the prediction, because that then you need to compare the two. And if they're close enough, then you'll have what we call a commuting diagram. I think it's obvious why it's commuting. When is something close enough to form a commuting diagram? Well, that's one of these things that we have to leave to the philosophers of science. Because when you form a commuting diagram is to say, this is a good enough model. And between the two of these, there's going to be some epsilon. And how big a gap you can tolerate is going to depend on what you're trying to use the experiment to argue towards. So if you have, you know, a reasonably large gap and you're an undergraduate in labs, then you're like, oh yeah, that's good enough. You know, it's probably doing this thing that all the textbooks say it's doing. If this gap is you're trying to prove the existence of the next thing after the Higgs boson, then you want it to be really small. So that's the epsilon. So that's the basic cycle of experimental science. No, it can't be.
Oh, it's not. Okay.
Yeah, because it's taking as its input a physical object and outputting an abstract object. A mathematical function would take an abstract input and an abstract output.
So I think I had a similar question. So what lives in the physical world is not mathematically formalized here. Now we assume that there is something happening.
Exactly.
This HP is not something that our theory would describe.
Yes, this is the fundamental problem of representation, that I've got to represent it to put it in a slide. Yes, this is the bit of, you know, you can tell why people like Wittgenstein went crazy, because as soon as you start thinking about representation, you have to use representation.
Basically, what we see in the lab are PNP prime, right?
Yes.
And that's it. Mm-hmm.
Well, what you see, yeah. We can have a very long conversation about what you actually see. Anyway,
I mean, if the representation is a problem, then how is the language of commuting diagrams even appropriate or well-defined?
What do you mean?
I mean, if your P and your P prime are not, I mean, if it's misleading to write them even down because this is already a representation, then, I mean, they are not mathematical objects, so you're not going to have a commuting diagram with a mathematical sense.
Yes, that's why I'm saying we call it commuting. I'm not saying it is mathematically commuting.
But what kind of thing is RT again? Can you elaborate a little bit?
It's a thing all on its own. It's the representation relation. Whatever it is that enables us to model something physical or something abstract, that's what it is.
Excuse me, just quickly, is this first attributed to Hertz? Is it first attributed to Hertz's work? The work by Hertz.
What's this work?
This idea of diagram, commuting diagram between physical world and mathematical structure.
I'd like to see it if it was.
Okay.
Yeah. So there's a couple of different, so it's very like some work on L machines that James Ladyman has done, and Owen Maroney also has something similar. So yeah.
My late far memory, but maybe.
Yes, there's also somebody at one point showed me something by a category theorist that did similar, but again, there it was functors and it was dealing with concrete semantics. So it wasn't actually, let's put the actual physical system into our theory and try to do it. So just looking at the time. Very briefly, one thing that we get out of this is the ability to represent different representations of the same system without needing a fundamental representation, because you can have one theory that abstractly represents the physical system as M, the other one abstractly represents it as N, and there need not be any connection between the two. That's connected to what's called strong emergence. But you can also have two representations where there is actually an abstract mapping between the two representations. And this ability to represent there being different representations without one being fundamental is very useful. I'll just go over this briefly. So this was something that came up when I was part of a project on emergence in philosophy, and we kind of have conversations where people would sort of refine everything down and say, well, the basic language that we've got to deal with is whatever fundamental physics tells us is there. So I put my hand up and said, what does fundamental physics tell us is there? Oh, whatever fundamental physicists tell us is there. Like, I might have some bad news for you because, you know, no one can agree. What is it? Is it the elements of field theory, string theory, or is it algorithmic information? Well, you don't have to decide in AR theory. In fact, what AR theory allows us to do is say there is no one fundamental representation. And just a plea, can we please stop basing our physics, our metaphysics, or our theories on a theory of everything that doesn't exist?
Here, here.
And this includes information theory. So this is the core of my beef with, let's take the world and let's say it's a bit string or several bit strings. So putting the names in just to locate, not to publicly shame or anything. So this idea that we heard that you can somehow translate between the entire universe and sets of bit strings by just imagine what a robot would see and store. Well, okay, what type of robot? What type of camera does that robot have? Because I know when I take photos and I want to email them, I'm given a list of resolutions and, you know, they take different computational signal strengths to get over. So what level of detail is this robot gathering? What types of detail can it gather? Is it just gathering information about the visual spectrum? What about the rest of the electromagnetic spectrum? And what about other properties? So one thing that we've found recently is that you can now detect gravitational waves. So is this robot capable of detecting and storing information about the gravitational field? Well, how much information is it going to need? Ultimately, you could end up with a robot that is...
Okay, quick response to that, I guess.
Only as soon as you put forward a theory of physics, you have to make a claim of representability in principle. When you put forward general relativity, you make a claim that you can represent space-time as a semi-Riemannian manifold, for example. It's just a claim, and you work with it. So he would just say, and there is some way to represent things as a bit string.
And that is exactly what AR theory says, but says how you represent it as a bit string is theory dependent. There is no one fundamental representation of the world as a bit string.
Yes, but isn't every other physical theory too, right?
But that gets that gets lost in the, because very much what I see out of things like algorithmic information theory is this idea you map from physics to bit strings, and that's it. And then you can start doing the theory. I'm saying, no, you have different mappings depending on what your physics is. And you cannot possibly talk about the about the bit string as fundamental without considering the physical theory that it came out of.
Sure. I wouldn't disagree with that. But maybe
excellent. Well, this is what I'm saying. I offer AR theory as, if you like, the lower level for algorithmic information theory. So, no universal concrete semantics. That's the, and no computational idealism.
No.
How do we want, how much longer have I got?
Well, we started 10 minutes late, so you've got about 15 left.
Yeah, because we've got the discussion period afterwards.
If there are short questions, feel free to ask them. But if they require longer responses, better to save that to the discussion, or for the question period and or the discussion.
Yeah. Okay. So, because I haven't even got to computation yet. So we've done experimental science. Great. We've not knocked that one off. So this is the use. This is, if you like, a full cycle diagram. Well, one thing we can do with it is when the theory is good enough, is we can drop the physical bit and use the abstract theory to predict what's going to happen. So you can predict physical things without actually needing to run the physical system. So that's scientific prediction. Now, representation, I've said, fundamentally was from physical to abstract. Can we reverse it? Can we have an instantiation relation? What would that mean? Well, this is more complicated. So it's very easy to come up with abstract models for physical objects at will. But if you have an abstract specification, producing a physical object corresponding to it is hard. I can give you abstract specifications like unicorns. Producing a unicorn is really difficult and maybe impossible. So we know that this thing isn't basic. It's got to stand in for something else. And just going very quickly over this, what it stands in for is engineering. So you can reverse a representation relation if you have a good enough theory that allows you to say, well, if I started at this physical system in a certain state, and I evolved it under some evolution, so that's engineering your system, then the abstract representation of the final state is going to correspond to what I want. It's going to correspond to my blueprint. This is difficult. This requires skill. It requires creativity. So reversing the representation relation, I said it's not an algorithmic process. I am guilty of using that in a non-rigorous sense. I'm meaning this is not straightforward, it's not fundamental. So the instantiation relation actually stands for a whole load of these commuting diagrams that are all building up to give you confidence enough in the theory that you have. And like I said, I'm not solving all the problems of theory, choice, and confidence and everything. Just saying, at the very least, this is what a good theory means. It means you can use it to engineer with. So that's how we get our instantiation relation. But you can't instantiate. The point is you can't instantiate an abstract specification in a physical object until you have a very good theory of that physical object. And this is core to computation. So what we're doing when we use a physical computer to compute an abstract computation is we have a problem in the abstract domain. We want an output in the abstract domain, but we're going to go via the physical domain to do it. And this is what we do. We start off with our abstract specification. So it's the initial state. And we instantiate that. So the engineering step is right at the beginning. A computer is an engineered object. And we instantiate it in the initial state of the computer. And so what we have, again, is this parallel, in a certain sense, evolution. So this C now is the computer program. And the output of that computer program, if you could somehow run it completely abstractly, would be M prime of P. But we're not running it completely abstractly. We're running it through the physical evolution of the computer and then representing the final, you know, state of all of the electrons in your computer. That is being represented abstractly. And if it's a good computer, then these two things will match. And what that means is that, like in scientific prediction, you can drop the physical part of the cycle and just use the abstract theory to predict the end state. You're doing the inverse when you're doing computation. You're, instead of going across the top with abstract evolution, what you're doing is, if you like, throwing it into the physical device and using the physical evolution of the computer to predict the outcome of the corresponding abstract evolution. So that's what a computer is. More precisely, we also have embeddings, because right down here, this is generally a specification in terms of machine code. And so you actually have to refine and encode your problem into the specification of how it will run on a particular device. But the fundamental idea is the same. Computing is the use of a physical system to predict the outcome of the abstract evolution that is the computation.
Wouldn't you pick the outcome of the instantiated evolution? What is the abstract then?
So the abstract evolution is the computer program.
Yeah.
So it's whatever abstract evolution that computer program is doing abstractly, you're predicting that by looking at the physical evolution of the computer. So you can have a slogan. So that's the slogan. If you take one thing away, take that away. Also, please take away the idea that the physical system matters. So just going briefly through this, we can then give things that need to be the case in order to have computing. So you require a highly engineered physical device, and you need to have a good theory of it, and it needs to be valid. You need representation and instantiation relations, and you need to be confident enough that over the domain that you're going to use your computer, your diagrams are going to commute. And we can talk about this, if people are interested, some more in the discussion, but ultimately Putnam's rocks don't predict anything. That's one reason why they fail as computers. No computation without representation. That's another thing to take away. There's an example of the different steps. So the theory, the encode, the instantiate, the run, represent, decode. These are all steps you need to give in order to say that something's computing. So I mentioned refinement a couple of times. And so refinement theory in computer science is how you get between different representations of the same program. So you can have, for instance, here, this example is you're doing an addition problem in decimal, well, there you can represent adding 1 to 2 in decimal notation in a certain way. But you can also compile that program down to a representation that just deals with binary addition. And this is, in fact, how this is the refinement stack for if you fire up Google and you say 1 plus 2 and hit return. So what it does is it translates it into a problem in binary addition and then translates it into machine code. Glossing over an awful lot of intermediaries. But this is known as a refinement stack. And where AR theory comes in is it puts the lowest level of the refinement stack. It's saying you cannot ignore this point at which you then take the machine code specification for the computation and then put it into the actual physical device. And that if we're to have a hope of using any of the theory up here for different types of physical devices, then we have to have that connection. So here's a can of worms I get to open. Where does the representation relation come from? What grounds it? What creates abstract representation from physical objects? So these are essentially observers. So we call them representational entities because this is very importantly the thing that grounds the representation relation. And in that checklist of when is something computing, you have to pick out, well, where is there representation? And for there to be representation, there has to be a representational entity. And there's two different ways that you can have compute cycles with representational entities. They can either be within the computational system that you're dealing with or external to it. So this laptop, with me as the computational entity, representational entity, that laptop in itself is not closed under representation because under certain circumstances it requires me to complete a compute cycle. Again, this is something we can talk about in the discussion. I'm glossing over an awful lot of stuff in those 6 or 7 papers here. So how do we tell whether or not there's a representational entity in the system? Well, often the representational entity is human, so you can just interrogate them. You can ask them what you're doing. For smaller systems, you can't do that. And so a lot of work that I'm not going to talk about, we've done in various biological systems. So we have to look at hallmarks of representation. We've got at least 2 papers on this. Feel free to go. We looked at computing happening in bacteria. And oh yeah, bacteria compute, leaves do not. That's a strap line to remember. So if I can take 3 minutes right at the end. So we've got a notion now of when physical systems are acting as computers. But there's 2 different types of AR cycles that you can have a computational representation for. So you could have a computational theory that, so this is, if you like, the whole machinery of standard computer science would be one example. So that can be participating in a compute cycle. But it could also be participating in something that looks very much like an experimental science cycle. So here, where you don't have any instantiation, so it's the direction of these arrows that are important. And in this case, the computational theory is being used to describe the physical dynamics, rather than the physical dynamics being used to instantiate the computational theory. So when can cycle 2 happen? Well, this is when we have a well-developed scientific theory of the physical device, and a well-developed computational theory that rests on top of that. Now, you always need a scientific theory first before you can have any kind of computational theory. At the very least, you need to know what degrees of freedom you're mapping your bits or your qubits or so on onto. So again, this comes back to there is no fundamental computational representation. You can see this as, if you like, expanding out this notion of different computational representations that we were talking about, that how you represent the world as a bit string depends on your physical theory, and that's exactly what's going on here. So if you have a really good scientific theory and a theory of computation that is able to stand on top of that, and you're able to compute with it, and you can do things like using your computational theory to predict things that are going to happen in your scientific theory, and then you're able to commute all of these diagrams. This is the ultimate aim of, if you have a well-characterized unconventional computer, it's going to end up with its diagram like this. That's saying that we know how the science works, and we know how the computation interfaces with the science, and we can slide between the different levels of representation. Now, if we do that, so this is saying we need to look at the scientific theory and try and extract out a logic from it. If we do that, then what we've got, ultimately, is a language at this level that is able to describe the scientific theory at that level. So quantum computing, just very, very briefly, this is something that's come up before. Why do quantum computers work? Why are they better than classical computers? Are they better than classical computers? What even does an answer to that look like? Here are some proposed answers to that. There's the first one, David Deutsch's famous one, you know, quantum computers are storing all of these bit strings in parallel and processing them in parallel. There's a couple of other options, but there's no universally agreed explanation for why quantum computers do what they do. This actually came across Twitter. It was brilliant. Somebody asked the question, a researcher in quantum engineering asked, okay, who's got a really good one-tweet explanation for why quantum computers work? And the replies were, oh, I'm not very good at putting this in 280 characters, but I'm sure somebody else does. But nobody actually gave an answer. And I would say there is a very good reason for that. We don't know. And the reason we don't know is because we do not have an understanding of what's going on physically in quantum mechanics. We don't have an interpretation of quantum mechanics. Now, why are you going to answer your puzzled look? Why is this the problem? Why is this the problem? Well, an interpretation of quantum mechanics is a high-level description of quantum processes. It's, if you like, a story of quantum processes. Now, one story we do have is quantum computing. So if you describe quantum processes in terms of qubits and CNOT operations, suddenly that's a model for what's happening in the quantum world. And this is very, very popular. And in fact, if you look at undergraduate textbooks now for quantum mechanics, a lot of them have started using this language. They've kind of grabbed hold of the one almost, you know, just slightly higher level language that we've got, because there are no others. However, it's not very high level. So this use of quantum computing as a descriptive language for quantum mechanics, we're stuck almost at machine code. So if you want to look at a quantum program. So this is a program for the teleportation protocol. You see in here, it's talking about C-naughts. It's talking about individual qubits. And you never get that in any form of human-readable classical computing language. So a classical computing language that you actually used, HTML, Java, or so on, you would never deal with the individual bit operations that are going on. You'd have much higher level concepts. So you would talk in terms of data structures and arrays and processes on them. All of that machinery we don't have for quantum mechanics. So how do we go up that level? How do we get quantum versions of things like what even would a quantum queue look like? But this is what I'm saying, we don't have that language. If we had that language, that would be a high-level representation of quantum theory. And part of the reason I'm arguing why we don't have that is because we've not solved the foundational problem. We've not solved the interpretational problem. We don't have, if you like, a human-readable explanation or interpretation of what's going on at the quantum world that we can use to develop high-level quantum data structures and processes and high-level quantum languages. So this, for me, is really where the rubber hits the road with quantum foundations, that we've now got a problem for quantum interpretations, and that is developing high-level quantum programming languages is the same thing as developing realist quantum interpretations. And so this is fundamentally what we should be looking at if you're interested at all in quantum interpretations. And I'm going to stop there.
We're over time, but perhaps we'll take one question and then continue the discussion.
Apologies for going over time.
Well, Christian, what's your very last sentence?
What? I'm going to stop there.
About realists in there. I mean, why would a quantum interpretation that is not a realist and answers your question not be satisfactory in this way? I mean, if a non-realist interpretation of quantum mechanics answers the question of providing a high-level programming language for quantum computers.
Mm-hmm. So
just remove the word realist, and then I would actually probably agree with what you said.
Well, we may be using... So I'm not... What I'm talking about is things like Copenhagen interpretations that just junk the idea that there's actually anything going on under there. So what we need is an interpretation that gives you some form of structure other than the simple equations. Because we've got the equations, and we've got the level of computational language that you can get out of the equations. That's where we're starting from. But we need something more than that. And what we need are essentially causal pictures, because that's what... So there's a lot of work in computational metaphors in computer science, how we get to these ideas that go into the high-level programming languages. And certainly everything that has been developed so far points to those need to be causal models. So it needs to be if A, then B type of model. If you could, I'm also struggling to think how a non-realist interpretation would give you any kind of understanding of what's going on,
but
that you could then develop into...
Providing a higher level of programming language,
mm-hmm.
not an explanation of what's going on. So there seems to be...
But I'm saying these are, I would argue, exactly the same question. The difference is, in one case, you're asking which is true, and in the other case, you're asking which ones can you build programming languages out of.
Okay.